I'm gonna stand.
Which one?
Works like this. It's green here, but.
Let me start this. So this is then a good illustration of the fact that today it's not only January 13, but it's also a Friday. So we couldn't expect anything else than this to happen. So I was asked to reflect a bit on the topic of today, quantitative methods in the social policies analysis, an evidence-based approach. And that is actually very much my field of expertise. So I'm happy that I have the possibility to share some of my thoughts about this topic. We are talking about the careful empirical analysis of the effects of social policies. And the next slides I will share with you my experience that doing that it's hard, doing that it's important, and doing that is not always rewarding because often policymakers don't get what they want. So what we conclude often doesn't make them happy. The first part, talking a bit about the fact that it's hard. So if you think about what are the effects of social policies, then basically we are always interested in something like what is the effect of some X, some program, some intervention that we are interested in. What is the effect of that X on some Y, some outcome that we are interested in? So the program can be we have cash transfers, or we give money to farmers not to cut their trees, give children that go to school, instead of letting them buy a uniform, we give them a school uniform, and then we are interested in things like, does this reduce poverty? Does this reduce deforestation? Or does this increase school attendance and school performance of children? So that is the type of things that we are interested in. And the issue is then always that we do not only want to know what happens if the child gets the school uniform, or if the family gets the cash transfer, but we also want to know what would have happened without the free school uniform and without the cash transfer. So there's always, we want to know what would have happened in the other world, the world that didn't happen, what would have happened in that other world. The issue is we are interested in a causal effect. What is the impact of X on Y? Whereas reality often only shows us what is the correlation between X and Y. And the question is then, how do we get from the correlation to a causal interpretation? The statement is then correlation does not imply causation, and probably in any kind of introductory methodology course, you heard this phrase, but it's easily said, but hard to tackle this issue in practice. So what we have seen in recent years in the field of economics is that there is an increase in that people do RCTs. What they do is randomized controlled trials. And that is kind of, in an ideal case, solving this problem of what would have happened in the other world, because what the other world is, that is then decided by throwing a coin. Some get head, the others get tail, and we can simply compare the outcomes of the two groups if the groups are big enough. So that would do the job. But we have been, Juan Ponce and I, we have been involved in kind of also getting some of these RCTs done in the setting of this country. That is not always easy to do. There's always concerns. There's concerns about the ethics of this. There's concerns about the cost of it. There's concerns about how long it takes before we have an answer to the question that we are asking. So what we see is that there's also, in the field of applied microeconometrics, people have made great advances in developing other methods than only doing RCTs disentangle these two things, the correlation and the causation. And these methods include doing difference indifferences, which is then assuming that some provinces or some cities, some areas are exposed to some treatment, others are not, but this was not randomly assigned as we would have wanted. And then the important thing is that there is a before measurement of the outcomes, there's an after measurement of the outcomes, and then we make assumptions to kind of infer something causal about what we are observing. There's other methods, and I listed them there, that economists are also more and more developing and using nowadays. The issue is always that whatever we do, in the end, we have to believe something, which sounds very unscientific, but if we throw a coin, then we have to believe that the coin was fair, and that indeed the people that are assigned to the treatment group are in every respect comparable to those that were assigned to the control group on average. We cannot prove that. We have to believe that. Well, this is probably something that is not so hard to believe. With other methods, what we have to believe is more demanding or stronger. So we have to impose stronger assumptions. So at the moment I'm teaching this course in Fluxo about RCTs and these other methods. These methods are technically not very demanding if the design of the research is right. Then the only thing that you have to do is compare one average to another average. That is technically not very sophisticated. And only when there's flaws in the design, you need to do more advanced things. Kind of one statement is then that no degree of econometric or statistical sophistication can compensate for mistakes in your research design if you do an RCT. That is different if you are, using other methods. What we typically see is that the harder part also gets in when the questions get more interesting. For example, we have the treatment group, we have the control group, but we have to worry about the fact that perhaps the treated affect the controls. then we have a problem in our interpretation of causal effects. So then there is matters of spillovers. So whenever we are evaluating a policy where this is a possibility, then we have to take that into account and somehow develop a design that addresses that issue. And also there we see in recent years great advances. There's this very famous study where they look at what is the impact of giving children treatment against worms. The big issue is that if some children are treated, other children, the control children, might benefit from that. So that instead of having both groups untreated, they both start here. We see the children that are treated, they get healthier. But the children that are not treated, because they benefit from the spillover, they also get healthier. So if we just compare the treated and the controls, then we would conclude that there's a very small effect. And that is actually what people for a long time, medical people for a long time, believed. Till economists from Berkeley and Harvard kind of came up with a design that addresses this externality. And then the conclusion was that indeed there's a big effect for the people that receive it, but there's also a big effect for the people that, well, benefit from the others receiving it. So typically, that is a hard thing to tackle, and what it needs is that to tackle an issue like that, people have to be creative, so they come up with a creative design to identify this externality. And the thing is, technically it's not hard, but the data collection can be very demanding and is extremely important. So careful analysis of the effects of social policies, it's hard, it's extremely important. And the reason is, of course, that many social policies, they are expensive, and every country can only spend its dollars once. And especially if, say, the price of oil is a bit low, then there's not so many dollars to spend. So then it's very important that you spend the dollars that you have in the most cost-effective way. And therefore it's important that governments are informed about if there's alternative policies to get the same thing done, then it's very important to be informed about is one policy more cost-effective than the other policy. And there is a nice study that kind of demonstrates that in the context of, well, if the thing that we want to do is to get a reduction in absenteeism of children in schools, then there's many things that you can do. That study then looks at these many things that you can do. You can give free school uniforms. You can give this warm treatment. You can also pay children to go to school. Well, these are different options, but their cost effectiveness differs enormously. So if you want to get this thing done, have all children every day in school, then it's important for a government that is kind of limited in its resources to do the thing that is most cost effective. This is then kind of shopping in my own experiences that what I did in the past did not always make policymakers happy. So this is different studies. And if I understand correctly, Juan will also give some examples of our experiences in this country. So this is experience not in this country, but in other countries. And so one type of interventions that we have been evaluating is so governments in many countries want their workforce to be kind of constantly updating their skills, and so they kind of stimulate workers to participate in training programs, and to do so they give them money, they give them vouchers. Basically, well, I give you this $1,000 account, and then you can participate in training. And where policymakers were very enthusiastic about this, because they were measuring the effectiveness of this program by asking people, how happy are you with this money and with the participation? And of course, they were happy with the money. And what we found is in that study that there's a very high deadweight loss, meaning that you were basically the largest part of the money that you were spending was spent on people that would have participated in the training anyhow, funded by themselves or funded by their employers. Another intervention that we studied that didn't make the policymakers that invented or that kind of came up with this policy happy was giving schools money to expand the number of computers that they have. There was implicitly a very nice design in how they did this, because they gave extra money only to schools that had at least 70% disadvantaged students. So what we could do is compare schools with 70% disadvantaged students with schools with 69.5% disadvantaged students. So that is kind of, randomly assigned almost treatment and control groups. And again, so their previous evaluation was asking the schools, are you happy with the money? And the schools say yes. They didn't ask whether the schools that didn't get the money were unhappy with not getting the money. But then we evaluated this by just looking what does this do to the performance of students on a nationwide test. And then our conclusion is that if anything, there is a reduction in the performance of the students. So we didn't make friends in the department, in the Ministry of Education with that. How am I doing on time? Not so good, eh? Okay. So then there was another program where also, so I'm skipping one point. A subsidy was given to employers to train their workers, but they were giving this subsidy if you were training your workers that were 40 years or older. And this was a tricky one, because if you would do here a regression discontinuity design, so compare workers that were 40 with workers that were 39, then you saw a huge increase in the training rates. So it looked like very effective, but if you had then not a closer look, but a wider look at the data, so also looked at what did this age pattern look like in previous years, then the clear conclusion was that this big difference in training rates between 39 years old and 40 years old was not because 40 years were suddenly more likely to be trained, but 39 years also suddenly less likely to be trained because employers, firms typically respond to incentives, so that's also what they did here. If next year it's cheaper to train you, then I postpone it for a year. So that is what was happening. So this sounds very much like careful analysis of social policies it's hard, it's important, it doesn't make people happy. So why would you do this? Like individually, because then you're always talking to grumpy people that kind of to whom you bring a message that they don't like. So kind of to also have a positive twist. Sometimes it makes them happy. Or at least sometimes you see kind of a change to what is good. So like a study that we recently did was in Sweden, where we were able to look at what is the impact of a reduction in class size in primary school on long-term outcomes. So typically if people look at what is the impact of class size reduction, they just look at the end of the year or perhaps 2 years further, are these students performing better in school? But that is nice if they perform better in school, but that's perhaps not what we really care about, because if this kind of fades out in the years after, then we have spent a lot of money kind of just to accelerate them a bit, but if the others kind of compensate later on, then there's not a real gain. So we were able to, and it was fantastic, in Sweden there's no privacy almost in the data of the statistical office, so we were able to merge the data of you as a child to the data of you when you were 40 years old and working in the labor market. And so we could see that if you were in a smaller class in primary school, that had as a return when you're 40 years old in earning a higher wage. So we found that, and the Swedish government took that serious and is now spending billions extra. Yeah, I can say billions because it's in Swedish kroners. So do you know what the exchange rate is? Billions of kroners extra on a reduction of class sizes. A thing that we did in our own university is you have in many schools, universities, places, you have incoming groups of students, big cohorts, and you divide them into different classes. Can we do this in ways that improves their performance, or does it not matter? So what we were allowed to do in my university is to the 600 students that start their undergraduate program in economics, we were allowed, so they are divided in 15 different groups, we were allowed to make different groups in terms of the smart students together and the not so smart students together, and groups that are mixed. And what we found is that do this grouping, disability grouping, enhances the performance of the not so good students. The not so good students, for them it's better to be in their own group than to be mixed with the smart students. And we did not only look at, like, in what group do we place them, how do they perform. We also kind of collected data in between, like, are there things happening that is like a channel through which this happens. And then, indeed, on the surveys, the not-so-smart students also answered that their peer interaction and like helping their fellow students is better in those groups where they are together than in the groups that are mixed. So on the basis of these results, our university has changed its placement of students in these groups. Basically having now a free game doesn't cost anything to group you differently. But it improves their performance. And finally, a project that I thought was very rewarding is in many school systems around the world, what you have is that children can choose between different schools, but then some schools are so popular that they cannot accept everyone that wants to go there. And then there's different mechanisms. How do we assign these students to the places that are in high demand? And there is different ways of doing this. So these are kind of, well, algorithms that mathematicians like a lot. But bottom line is there's different ways of doing that. And some ways are ways where parents might regret what they did later on, whereas other ways don't have that. The only thing that you have to do is to report your true preferences, and you cannot regret what you did, but you can be unlucky. And like in my home city in Amsterdam, we were able to kind of work together with the schools and work together with the city to change the system. 1 minute, but 1 hour, and to change the system such that, everyone is like now more satisfied with the system that we now have than the system that they had in place for a long time. So, that is kind of the positive side. So sometimes you're also able to influence policy in the direction that it. That it makes people happier. And I leave it here.